We have a very special presentation for this afternoon. We're going to see an exhibition debate from four very, very talented debaters, who I'd like to introduce. Before that, I would like to introduce the person who will be doing the flow for you. That's Seth Bowser. They're going to write out everything on the flow, so if you don't, if you lose something or miss something, you'll be able to compare it after each speech to what she has written on the board. She'll be doing a very good flow, so you can see how it should turn out. A little background on that: she's a rising senior at Emory University. She is an honor student in Spanish and French linguistics. Has won numerous awards for academic quality. That was a national level debater for Milton High School, where she came on to make some top high school debaters. She has also performed several exhibition debates for 11 UDL students and worked at the Emory National Debate Institute. She won the Academic Excellence Award for the past 3 years and is a Dean Scholar on the basis of her outstanding performance. If we can once again welcome Vince Valdez. We have an epic struggle with four very fine debaters for the nation's death for you to observe and learn from. I'd like to introduce the first affirmative, Johnny Justin. A little background on Johnny. Johnny's won the original. She was a member of the Atlanta Urban Debate League during his junior and senior year and became one of the top individual debaters in the state of Georgia. He and his partner won the Georgia State Championship. He was recruited by several colleges in 10 different states and received a full tuition and business scholarship based on debate to the University of Alabama, where he finished in the elimination round of the CA National Championship in his first year of debate. He was an Emory Scholar at the Emory National Debate Institute and served as a faculty advisor for 3 years. He has been a mentor at the NYUDL and worked as a faculty at the University of Vermont's World Debate Institute. He has also been an active participant in the Tuscaloosa Debate League in Alabama. Once again, let's welcome Johnny Justin. The second affirmative is Ms. Leslie Wade. Leslie is a rising senior at Emory University, where she is a Dean of Students, majoring in psychology and philosophy. She has won numerous awards in national intercollegiate debate competitions, including the University of Kentucky National Championship Tournament for first-year college debaters. She finished in a tie for 8th place at the 1997 Varsity College National Championship at Wichita State University of over 500 participants from 35 states. Very rare for a first-year debater. She's been a faculty member at several debate institutes, including Emory, the University of Kentucky, Stanford University, University of Missouri at Kansas City, and Dartmouth. She is not currently debating so that she can focus on her honors work in both of her majors and attend on applying to graduate programs in psychology. She finished her honors in philosophy prior to the beginning of her senior year. She will take on only graduate level courses this year during her senior year. Please welcome Leslie Wade. Speaker will be Russ Dawkins. Russ was a top campus debater at Highland Park High School in Dallas, Texas. He was selected as a fellow at the University of Kentucky National High School Debate Institute, an honor reserved for the top 12 rising seniors in debate across the United States. He received a full 4-year tuition award as part of the Emory Scholars Program as a member of Phi Beta Kappa at Emory University, where he is a rising senior. Last year, he finished as one of the top 10 best seeds and weapons in intercollegiate debate. He finished as the 5th speaker at the CA National Championship while also finishing as the 5th place seed. He won several tournaments last year, received national round robin invitations, and finished as the top 10 speakers at every tournament he attended. It's a pleasure to have him join us in New York this year. Please welcome Russ Dawkins. Last but certainly not least, Shanara Reed. Shannara is a senior debater at Emory University, where she is currently majoring in political science and African American studies. Shannara was a finalist of the Martin Luther King Scholar Program at Emory University. Shannara spent 4 years at Sarah High School, where she won multiple awards at the competitive Georgia Circuit. Shannara has secured her involvement in the Tennessee debate in Atlanta as both a judge and a coach for the past 4 years. As a member of Emory's debate team, she is one of only 5 students to be invited to 3 national round robin tournaments held for the top 9 teams in the United States. Shannara was 16th at the national this year and called the first all African American team to qualify for the elimination round. She was the Bell University Debater of the Year and won Emory's Unsung Heroine Award last year as well. This summer, Shannara worked at the Wake Forest University College Fund and the University of Vermont World Trade Institute. Please welcome the second Megan speaker, Shannara Reed. As the debaters come up, they will introduce to you what they are doing, what they will be thinking about, and what the role is of that speaker. During the round, some of the other faculty members and staff will be circulating, making sure that you're keeping a good flow, that you're involved in the process, and that we can be helpful in whatever way. Please enjoy the exhibition today. Okay, can everybody hear me? Can people hear me now? Can people hear me now? Okay, good. Get for me. I'm the first person to start this. I'll be reading the 118. I'm not sure what I'll be thinking as I read the 118, but the purpose of the 118 is to provide structure for the debate. You couldn't debate without the 118. Is there a way to turn off the thing? Okay, that idea is vetoed. That's okay, Tony. Ready? Operation among the Sandstorm team, co-educational schooling has been a disaster. Co-ed schools, favor male, teacher body operates for silent girls and degrees that participate in COVID-98. American public school classrooms have disadvantaged girls according to the AAUW report that American public classrooms, boys receive more teacher attention time and energy than girls. Your boys call our answers, teachers listen to their comments, whether they are insightful or irrelevant. When girls call our answers, however, teachers suddenly remember their rule about raising their hands before talking and instruct girls to raise their hands. This system of policy operates covertly and repeatedly and occurs several times a day each week during the 12 years of school and longer girls choose to go to college. And most of the students call it happens subliminally. Girls learn not to participate in class. The effectiveness of male culture is to substantially reduce the achievement of girls, particularly in math and science. Low achievement in these subjects create self-doubt and shadow girls' self-esteem, COVID-98. The consequence of girls' consciousness is that they miss the teacher feedback that is crucial to achievement and self-esteem. Boys receive praise and mediation and criticism the most. These reactions foster achievement. Girls receive primarily acceptance. Acceptance does not operate to inform girls when they are wrong. If girls do not know when they are wrong, they cannot learn from their times unless they are learning from their mistakes. Developing the perspective to see failure as an educational tool necessary for long-term academic success. Girls begin to attribute their poor grades to lack of ability. I'm just not smart in math. When girls lose confidence in their ability to learn math and science, they avoid these subjects. As they have fewer and fewer experiences with math and science, they become less capable. Their confidence raises so that their self-esteem and the vicious connected cycle continues. The attenuation of self-confidence leads to the loss of mental ability and results in the diminishment of self-confidence. Body construction effects on self-esteem is disastrous. It makes girls more vulnerable to their surroundings, increasing depression, eating disorders, suicide, substance abuse, and unplanned pregnancy, and HIV risk. COVID-1998. Low self-esteem and negative body images set the stage for depression in teenage girls. Adolescent girls are 4 to 5 times more likely than one to attempt suicide. Low self-esteem also leads to substance abuse. Besides, adolescent girls often turn to sexual activity and motherhood in order to feel good about themselves and have a purpose for their life. More than 1 million teenage girls become pregnant every year. drugs. We have children who usually drop out permanently, usually drop out of school permanently without an education. These girls have difficulty finding jobs to support themselves and their families. Motherhood is not the only consequence of unprotected adolescent sexual activity. Teenage girls are 13 through 19, representing 24.9% of reported AIDS cases among females. Observation 2. Efforts to establish single-sex schools are failing. Title IX is preventing single-sex schools. Straight out of 1999, during the late 1980s and early 1990s, school districts in Baltimore, Milwaukee, New York opened African-American publicly funded academies for males. In all cases of the school boards or boards rules of these academy matches, mid girls were closed because of they violated Title IX. Although public policy allows for the existence of single-sex schools in private, there are very few unchallenged regardless of the case made for their purpose and need. Because the status quo has serious issues, we advance the following. The U.S. federal government will establish an education policy that will mandate that states experiment with single-sex schools as long as comparable opportunities exist for both sexes. Legislation will clarify that Title IX does not prohibit the existence of single-sex schools, and the Department of Education's interpretive guidelines will be changed to accommodate the claim. Observation 3. Check it. We talk. Single-sex schools create role models for boys and girls, increasing self-confidence and breaking down traditional stereotypes of women. California, 1994. There is also much evidence to suggest that single-sex schools actually reduce the stereotypes about proper roles for men and women. Girls who attend girls' schools are less likely to be co-educated girls and harbor attitudes of accountability and work for motherhood of roles of men as the primary achievers. In addition, same-sex learning environments appear to liberate the sexes across stereotypical gender lines for females. Single-sex schools eliminate the conflict between the services and sex stereotypes for women. So girls who tend to shy away from competition with boys for fear of appearing unfeminine and intimidating are free to pursue leadership roles that might normally be exclusive topics for boys and boys' schools. For males, when boys' schools, every activity will, by definition, be the preserve of boys. There is less stigma attached to the unstereotypical behavior. In single-sex settings, there is no such thing as stock-out gender territories to infringe upon. And lastly, data from the National Center of Education Statistics proves that single-sex schools substantially increase academic achievement for girls by eliminating male culture. California, 1994. A variety of different studies will conclude that single-sex school education is beneficial for female academic achievement. After analyzing data from the National Center of Education Statistics, sociologists determined that girls single-sex schools outscore girls in co-ed schools by a full grade on four general academic ability tests and by a full grade on science tests. Of male peers in the classroom appears to create more openly academic, less pressureful atmosphere for girls. Girls in girls' schools are more likely to average, on average, than co-ed girls to want others to remember them as foremost as brilliant students.
The federal
government will mandate that every state experiment with single-sex schools.
Okay. Let's talk about the single-sex schools. That's split up by all males go to one school in a separate building, all females go to school in another separate building?
Right.
Okay. Why would those school systems be equal to each other?
Well, because we don't change the way Title IX operates. So the Title IX and the plan rhetoric says that comparable schools have to exist for both sexes. So,
how do you define what comparable is?
Like if a boys' school has $30,000 for the football team, then the girls' school will have $30,000 for the football team.
Sure, but that comparable situation between schools doesn't happen between like black and white schools. Why would it happen between male and female schools?
Well, because first of all, the comparable existence for black and white schools are based on property tax, right? Because most black schools are in neighborhoods where the property tax is low, so the educational funding can't go to those schools. Like, we wouldn't change any of that. That happens in the status quo. All we say is that comparable, is it better? All we say is that
comparable opportunities have to exist for both sexes in both schools.
Right, but you don't guarantee that those comparable opportunities mean that if they spend $30,000 on football, then female schools should spend $30,000 on football too.
It's guaranteed just as much as the status quo guarantees it.
Right, but what does that mean? How does Title IX protect people in the status quo, and how does the plan continue that protection?
Well, currently in the status quo, Title IX protects people, whereas if you go to an all-black school, you get the same opportunity as an all-white school. It doesn't.
Right, but that opportunity doesn't necessarily exist in the status quo, so how can we guarantee that it exists between males and females?
Well, we don't change like that, the way that opportunity goes.
You don't change it, which means you don't solve. So how do you solve within the current structure that means that there is no comparable situation between schools?
But that's not a solving thing, right? Like, it happens in the status quo. We just say that
post-plan females will get less funding than males, i.e. like blacks get less funding than whites do.
No, we don't want it.
No, so you have to answer that.
We don't say that girls' schools have to be in a neighborhood where the property tax is lower, so we don't mandate that there is less funding for girls' schools. Now, if girls' schools happen to be in a neighborhood where they have a church, then that's the same situation that happens in the status quo, right? We don't change the race.
So there's no way that the plan equals better education for females in the status quo?
No, that's not true, because
how does the plan overcome that barrier that if males are considered to be the people we should educate and females are considered the people that we should not educate, which is what the inherent of the affirmative assumes, why wouldn't it be true that if we send all the females who we shouldn't educate to the same school? I want to answer my question because you didn't answer the whole process. How do you solve that situation? How does the plan overcome that barrier?
Right. The situation that you're describing is indicative of the status quo.
Right, and the plan that you're doing doesn't solve that status.
Well, that's...
All right, let's close for you guys. You guys are awesome. Okay. Hello? All right. Sarah C? Please don't sit down. Sarah C? Everyone's scared.
Yeah.
All right. This is Operation 1. I did a lot of abbreviating to help you guys out, but this is 1AC. We're going to go through that one card by card. We're going to go through the 1AC card by card, and then the rest of the time we're going to put them up and not talk about it, okay? We're going to help you out. All right, Operation 1, the first card is, public schools favor males. Teacher bias silences girls and decreases participation. Roman 98. Are we following? Is everyone on the same page? Second card is that the male culture decreases academic achievement of women in math and science and decreases self-esteem, Coleman in 98. The third card is decreasing self-esteem leads to depression, eating disorders, and all the other stuff that you get, like HIV and suicide, Coleman in pregnancy, Coleman in 98. All right, the inherency card is, that should be a new sheet of paper, DCW, all right. Operation 2, Title IX, block single-sex schools now. That's Frank Leiter, 99. Am I going too fast? Okay, good. Everyone's cool. All right, that was the only inherency card, right? And you should have planned before that, but you usually don't get planned word for word. You usually read it. All right, Operation 3, sovereignty. Single-sex schools. The role models in women and men, increase self-esteem, and watch the traditional gender stereotypes. That was 94. And the last card that you read was intersexual, kill the male culture, or the male culture, and all that thing. Okay, that was it. That was easy, right? Yeah. All right, now what are we remembering? We're remembering to abbreviate. SSS stands for? All right, the little circle with the stick and the little cross thing is? A woman? Sorry. That was a very good example of it. All right, that's woman, female, that's male, right? We're all catching on to that. We want to write as little as possible, so we want to abbreviate a lot. We have all your cool little abbreviations. The circle with an X is exactly. Okay, cool. So everyone else has their own abbreviations. Don't be afraid to make up your own. And remember, don't be afraid to take out the vowels of words because you can read them with just the consonants. Like teacher, T-C-H-R. Okay, so we're going to the one end now.
90, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, 80, make sort of offensive arguments against the case. And I'm also going to answer the recent cards on the case to answer what Johnny just said, especially on their advantage and on solvency. So you need four name sheets of paper, one for each of the off-case positions.
One more call.
And I don't know, answer harms, which is observation one, and solvency, which is observation three, specifically. And now I'm going to move. Thank you for me, because I haven't debated standing up in like 3 or 4 years. Okay, you guys should, like, if you have flow paths, rip off the 4 pieces of paper for the off case, as well as the 3 pieces of paper that you have for the 1AC. Because your order is going to be changing around a lot, and you're going to need easy access to all those pieces of paper. So you have your paper still attached to your pad, so I had to rip it up. But try not to rip it right down the middle, like I always do when I use legal pads. Try to rip it at the top so you can still read what you write.
I guarantee you at some point you're going to get lost.
Oh, that's okay.
So you got it right at the first place. You hate it.
You hate it.
But the team.
Are you?
Yes, four off case, and then observation one, which was the harm or the advantage, and then observation three, which was solvency. Okay, so is everybody ready? Okay. All right, here we go. First observation of topicality. A is definition of one. Establish means to create or bring into existence. From words and phrases from 1964. Establish means to create or bring into existence. Two, an education policy is a policy that mandates the goals, mechanisms, and operations of the education system from the Educator's Dictionary in 1994. B, the violation. The affirmative plan does not establish an education policy. It mandates that the states establish education policies. C, our interpretation is superior. One, limits. The affirmative interpretation crushes the negative ground by substantively removing the federal government from the implementation of education policy. That eliminates the resort of generic solvency arguments, links to federal government disadvantages like inflation and politics, and the state's counterclaim. All those positions are the heart of the negative topic area. Secondly, is academic achievement proves our interpretation. The wording of the resolution requires that the federal government's education policy increase academic achievement. The affirmative establishes an education policy that allows the states to establish an education policy to increase academic achievement. This proves that at best, the affirmative affects topical, both mixing burdens and further limits the topic. These are points. Topicality is voting issue for reasons of fairness and education. The next off case is federalism. A, amicus. Recent Supreme Court rulings have created a balance of power between the states and federal government. The Washington Post in 1999. The Supreme Court is controlled by justices who avoid both serfs and resist rulings that dramatically reinterpret the nation's laws, but one area remains an exception, the abolition of the powers of the federal government and the states. In recent years, the resolute 5-justice majority has been shoring up the authority of the states at the expense of the Congress. So during oral arguments yesterday, the majority appeared poised to deepen its imprint in favor of states' rights or federal authority. Cast more broadly, these cases offer the court a chance to further retreat from 6 years of expansively interpreting federal authority. In recent years, the narrow but potent majority has emphasized the states have legitimate interests of the Congress. Respect. B, the links. First, education is a state responsibility. The federal education policy is threatened by the states. Cheverly in 1998. In the United States, individual states have this degree of power that exceeds that found in most other federal systems. The states, for instance, have primary responsibility for public health safety, education, and administration of justice. Education is punished. A good example. Local governments even provide most of the funding for education. They construct schools and teachers and so forth. The states largely define the curriculum set the qualifications for teachers and otherwise exercise control over public education. Secondly, this relationship is zero sum. Federal power always decreases state power, from Nell in 1992. Inherent equality of state and federal government creates a zero-sum power struggle. The universe of power is finite, and that universe is divided between state and national governments. Any increase in national power results in an equal reduction in state power. Dual federalism thus shuns any cooperation between the two sovereigns because it would necessitate a decrease in state power. C, the impacts. First, the disadvantage trends the case. Unbalanced systems create depression and prevent state solvency from material in 1999. The reasons we protect federalism are well rehearsed. First, by splitting power between levels of government, federalism dilutes power and protects individuals from government oppression. In this regard, federalism shares goals and principles of separation of powers, which divides power among branches of government to prevent concentration of power. Secondly, federalism preserves state and local governments as laboratories for policy experimentation. Each state is free within the confines of the federal constitution to experiment with novel solutions to shared problems. Thus, experimentation should hasten in progress, and several states can learn from one another's experiences. Secondly, U.S. federalism is modeled internationally. The balance of power is key to preventing worldwide wars, from Ornstein in 1992. The potential for self-destruction, atomization, substantial bloodshed, even all-out war is very great. It is a delicate matter to find structures that can lay primal fears of genocide, legitimize the emerging national identities, and divide up economic and political powers and goodies in a fashion that we've seen is fair to everybody. It is here that creative federalism can play its role. The United States may be able to at least point the way. Our innovations in decentralized federal arrangements, as well as our experience in sorting out powers and rights between Washington and the states, could well be adapted to many troubled situations elsewhere today. The next observation is the state's counterplan. The negative offers a call on dispositional counterplan. The United States Supreme Court, the next available test case, will rule that education should be devolved to the states as a state right, and that Title IX will be reinterpreted to allow state experimentation in single-sex schools. Observation 1, counterplan is not topical. It doesn't take federal action. Observation 2, the counterplan is net beneficial. It solves the case and avoids the federalism disadvantage. States are leading in innovations to solve education problems. John Engler in 1997. The national leaders of education reform have been the states. Washington bureaucrats. More parental involvement, higher students, fair discipline, increased autonomy for teachers, more choice for students and their families. These are the keys to improving our public schools and making it the best in the world. Governors have long understood that. They have led the burgeoning charter school movement, which is injecting competition to the nation's public schools. Now there are hundreds of these innovative schools around the nation, including 116 in California, 114 in Arizona, and 74 in Michigan. Now into the case, so I'm with observation 1. First, girls have higher academic achievement than boys. Higher grades prove this. Kleinfeld, professor of psychology at the University of Alaska in 1999. If schools are shortchanging females, such gender discrimination should be easy to spot. Schools give clear and measurable awards, grades, class rank, academic honors, and prizes. From grade school to graduate school, females receive higher grades, even in mathematics and sciences. They also receive more academic honors in every field except science and math. The female advantage of grades appears in virtually every study. Data from a wide variety of sources in educational settings show that females in all ethnic groups tend to earn higher grades in school than do males. Moderately, the subjects are unanimous in their findings of higher grades for females. Secondly, the NAEP test scores prove that the math and science gap is shrinking. We find fault again in 99. As for the male advantage in mathematics and science, it is shrinking. The National Assessment of Educational Progress has measured the knowledge of 17-year-olds in mathematics and science for 20 years. In mathematics, the gender gap has declined significantly since the 1970s and no longer reaches statistical significance. In science, the gender gap has also declined. Third is gender equity programs are solving now. Kleinfeld again in 99. Mathematics and science education for girls has indeed improved. The National Science Foundation, other government agencies, private foundations, and universities have developed and funded an array of gender equity programs. The program for women and girls at the National Science Foundation alone has an annual budget of $9 million a year for such efforts. Fourth is girls have higher self-esteem. The MetLife study proves. Kleinfeld again in 99. For many years, Metropolitan Life supported studies of important issues facing the public schools. In 1997, their report focused on gender issues based on a nationally representative sample of 1,306 students. The report concludes bluntly. Contrary to the commonly held view that boys have an advantage over girls in schools, girls appear to have an advantage over boys in terms of their future plans, future expectations, everyday experiences in school, and interactions in classrooms. Teachers nationwide view girls as higher achievers and more likely to succeed as boys. Now I'm solvency on observation 3. First, single-sex schools don't impact achievement. Socioeconomic status is more important. Black and Education Research Consultants in 1998. Do such experiments in single-sex education make a difference in student achievement? Not really. Socioeconomic status counts for more than gender in the classroom. Kids who come from poverty-stricken homes without the advantage of good nutrition, books, and music, and other early learning opportunities are likely to start school several steps behind classmates who come from more affluent families. Second, term. Single-sex schools stigmatize girls as being special help. Von Lohman and J.D. at Stanford in 1995. Single-sex math and science classes may offset a legacy of discrimination. However, such programs may rest just as easily upon notions of girls' different learning styles or natural inabilities in math and science. Of equal, if not greater importance, is the problem of stigma. Often people believe that all girls' classes are less challenging, thereby reinforcing traditional stereotypes about girls' lack of native ability in math and science, regardless of the school's intention in adopting such programs. Third, term. Single-sex schools promote sexist instruction. Julian Davis, the CEO of Women in Philanthropy at the National Organization for Women in 1995. Equity demands breaking down social stereotyping, which reinforces models of male strength and female weakness. Single-sex settings may be enacted at this goal. According to researcher Valerie Reed at the University of Michigan, a study of all male private schools revealed that male teachers perpetuate sexism by teaching male students to view women as sex objects and by socializing them to maintain power and control over women in sexual interactions. Dr. Lee believes that the lower instance of teacher-initiated sexism in public schools could result in repressed girls, which may inhibit the development of runaway sexism. Fourth argument is a term. Single-sex schools create sexual imbalances in co-ed schools. Black again in 98. Single-sex schools have unintended consequences, including a negative effect on social equality. Skipping off boys or girls and allowing them to attend separate schools can leave behind an unequal ratio of males and females, a problem researchers say districts often overlook when they approach single-sex programs. The last argument is a term. Single-sex schools increase resource competition, creating sexism by pitting boys' schools against girls' schools. Truly in Davis again in 1995. The crisis in this country's public education system is a devastating impact on both male and female students of color. Solutions that separate the sectors may exacerbate sexist attitudes, particularly among boys who promote sex-based inequality. Targeting one group of victims of discrimination and isolation from the needs of others evades the responsibility of school systems to treat all students without bias. Instead of pitting boys against girls in the race for allocating scarce educational dollars, educators should focus on building, rather than eroding, the equity achieved in law and social policy during the past 30 years, promoting the implementation of strategies that expand awareness, reform, and impact of sexism as well as racism in education, and strengthening the coalition supporting equity in the United States public education.
Yes.